When it comes to a good thriller, nothing can kickstart a story like a case of mistaken identity, when someone insists they're not who you think they are. Well, today, author Alex Gilvary recommends his favorite fictional case of mistaken identity for our series, You Must Read This.
I was a college student in New York City when security checks became the norm. Being half Filipino with a Scottish last name, I wasn't easy to profile. And since I was always carrying a big backpack of textbooks in and out of the subways on my way to class, I came to expect that I would be stopped once or twice each week. And the fear, which I felt each time I was asked to step aside, was that I would be mistaken for someone else, a suspect out to disrupt the city I'm from and love most of all. There is no book that encapsulates this fear better than I'm Not Stiller by the Swiss writer Max Frisch, which begins just so. While traveling through Zurich, our narrator is stopped by the authorities because he closely resembles one Anatol Ludwig Stiller, an unsuccessful sculptor, husband, lover, and all-around failure of a man who disappeared 6 years earlier. One smack to an official's ear later, Stiller, presumably, is detained in a very humane Swiss prison until he will admit that he is the missing man. From the confines of his cell, Stiller reports on his life in detainment with invigorating rage, insisting that he is most definitely not Stiller, but an American named White, a cowboy who has traveled the Mexican desert and beyond, and who isn't afraid to commit a murder or two when pressed. As Stiller is confronted by his abandoned ballerina wife, his former mistress, an estranged brother, and a cast of bourgeois sophisticates from Stiller's life, the novel intertwines a classic tale of mistaken identity with high comedy and post-war seriousness. Is Stiller's testimony of his life the unvarnished truth, as he claims? Or is his version a last-ditch effort in deception, a denial of an identity he despises? We don't know, and therein lies the beauty of experiencing I'm Not Stiller. For anyone who likes their narrators served unreliably, you must read this. Frisch, who first achieved renown in Germany as a dramatist before the publication of Stiller in 1954, never ceases to entertain with his plain, direct style and entrancing digressions. And while he probes those daunting existential questions of identity, freedom, and morality with sly dramatization, we find ourselves actively piecing together the mystery of a man's identity with much more delight and humor than any of Frisch's post-war compatriots. I first read I'm Not Stiller nearly 10 years ago, just as I was beginning to write my own stories, figuring out my own identity. The novel stuck with me all these years because of the way it resonates with our changed landscape of curtailed freedoms and paranoia. As we anticipate a new post-war era, perhaps reconciling with our own national identity, I can think of no better time to read Frisch's version of a man trying to flee his own.
Alex Gilvary is the author of From the Memoirs of a Non-Enemy Combatant.
Next, we have the story of a Midwestern kid who grew up differently than many people around him. In the 1980s, Eyad Akhtar was living in Wisconsin, an American kid born of Pakistani-American parents who were Muslim.
People, at least in the Midwest, where I was growing up, didn't really even know what Muslims were. So, I mean, my friends knew that I was from somewhere, or my parents were from somewhere different, but you weren't really sure what that place was. And, you know, after all, I did like the Green Bay Packers, so it didn't really matter. You know what I mean?
As long as you've got that, you're allowed. You're allowed into Wisconsin.
I'm from Wisconsin.
Eyad Akhtar grew up to be a writer. He is the author of a novel called American Dervish. It explores the difficult subject of Islam in America. It's about a kid named Hyatt growing up in Wisconsin. He's American-born, but his ancestral country and religion catch up with him when his mother's best friend Mina arrives from Pakistan.
She's a charismatic and brilliant, beautiful woman. And so she influences Hyatt in a number of ways. He experiences his first sort of awakenings of the heart and of the body in her presence. And he also is introduced to Islam, which is something that his parents don't have much interest in. And he really takes to that.
And this is really fascinating to me, that you have this woman who the boy meets who is religious, but in a very progressive and open way, and talks about reinterpreting the faith for modern times, something that more conservative Muslims would reject. The boy is under her influence, and yet he becomes, for a time anyway, a very conservative young Muslim.
Well, he does because he begins to feel that there is some certainty that he can latch onto by reading the book, the Quran, in a literal way. And the sort of central emotional through line of the book has to do with his burgeoning jealousy when Mina falls in love with a Jewish man, and he feels that he's losing his love object.
This could have been a much simpler story because you have this boy who's Muslim, who's in the United States, who is inspired by Islam and at least for a time becomes a very conservative, purist kind of Muslim. I mean, mm-hmm. he could have been inspired by a radical blind cleric to that approach and mm-hmm. become some kind of wild-eyed radical. You chose to make things far more nuanced all the way through.
I think that's true to life. I've seen a lot of things, growing up in this country as a young Muslim, and I haven't seen that particular, embodiment, what you were describing, because even the sorts of things that I may have seen which coincide with what you're talking about with your example, even those are more nuanced. I think it's always a more complicated picture.
Is it fair to say that Islam doesn't come off terribly well in this book?
It's a question that I've gotten from time to time, but I also get the other side, which is that people say, wow, I read your book and I can't believe how beautiful Islam is. So I think, as with all of the characters in the book, I try to embody them with all of the complexity and the strengths and the flaws that they have. And I think that I'm trying to do the same thing when it comes to representing the practice of the faith.
Well, let me mention just a couple of things that I think a lot of Americans would find alarming. One of the characters, this older woman, Mina, when she's in Pakistan, is divorced by her husband just after giving birth to a baby, simply by having the husband send a note that says 3 times, I divorce you, which is mm-hmm. all you're supposed to have to do under Islam. You have that. You have prejudice against Jews, open prejudice against Jews, jokes being told about Jews and so forth all the way through the book.
Well, I think the jokes are often told by a Jewish character. So, I mean, it's you can dig a little deeper, Steve. I think there's darker stuff than that in the book. There is at the centerpiece of the book, there is a sermon in the mosque that begins with sort of cryptic allusions to verses in the Quran that talk about Jews. And then it becomes an outright anti-Semitic sermon. So, I think that the book has a very, how do I put it? It would be impossible to read, for example, the Old Testament and not to remark or to have some awareness of the fact that the characters in the stories in the Old Testament are profoundly flawed. And I think that I'm bringing the same perspective to the Quran, which is to say that there are extraordinary things, things of extraordinary beauty and wisdom in the Quran, and then there are also there's also stuff that is darker. And that's true, again, to the human psyche. These are books which the Quran, the Old Testament, the Gospels, they're books that embody the fullness of the human experience. And for anyone to suggest that they don't have that darker side, which we ourselves have, I think is, again, only part of the picture.
Ayad Akhtar is the author of American Dervish. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Now the latest entry in our series, 3 Books, where authors talk about 3 books on one theme. Today, the antidote to a recent trend in fiction, the painfully perky female character. Author Heather Havrileski recommends the stories of 3 leading ladies who kick and scream their way to the very last page.
In this age of bland romantic comedy leads, when the feminine ideal seems to mix 2 parts sweetly smiling Jennifer Aniston with 3 parts saucer-eyed Rapunzel, nothing can bring more satisfaction than the anti-heroine. She's a female, short in temper and long in erotic tics, whose life is defined by her worst choices. Teddy, the protagonist of Kate Christensen's riveting novel The Great Man, not only shamelessly flaunts her status as the mistress of a legendary New York artist, but she doesn't even consider making apologies to his wife after he dies. At 74, Teddy steadfastly refuses to become the dignified shell of a woman that society expects of her. The other women in her lover's life, his loyal but put-upon wife and his competitive, bitter sister, mirror much of Teddy's verve and stubbornness. Incredibly, Christensen manages to make all of these sharp older women frustrating, yet eminently lovable. Next, we come to what may be the single most detestable female character ever created, Harriet, the protagonist of Iris Owen's 1973 novel, After Claude. She's arrogant, yet horribly insecure. But even as her situation goes from bad to unthinkable, and her behavior goes from desperate to unseemly to horrifying, Harriet reflects something essential about how it feels to be a single female. This book is an absolute must-read for every smart, moody woman who's ever been told she loves too much or thinks too much. Phyllis Thoreau may be the biggest overthinker of them all, and that's saying a lot among this neurotic bunch. The author, who is also, oddly enough, Jennifer Aniston's possible future mother-in-law, has written a memoir called The Journal Keeper. That's everything we're told a memoir shouldn't be: rambling, self-indulgent, and only loosely chronological. Luckily, Thoreau has plenty of courage in her convictions, revealing a rich inner life that might never be as colorfully expressed in a more traditional format. The irony of it all? This book will make you wish you were Jennifer Aniston so that you might spend more time in the company of a sometimes irascible, always large-hearted anti-heroine like Phyllis Thoreau. Because in a world dominated by perky little girls with sunny dispositions and endless wells of optimism, nothing soothes the soul quite like a foul-tempered old lady spitting fire.
Heather Haverleski is the author of the book Disaster Preparedness. She's also a regular contributor to the New York Times Magazine.
Teresa Carpenter is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and former senior editor of The Village Voice. Her new book is an anthology of the diaries of New Yorkers. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says it's the perfect collection to read for a sense of perspective as we enter a new year.
Most everyone's spirits are a bit deflated after the holidays. So as a literary antidote, I recommend a just-published anthology called New York Diaries, 1609 to 2009. Editor Teresa Carpenter has collected four centuries' worth of diary excerpts written by people great and small who've lived in or just passed through one of the greatest cities in the world. As a bulwark against the January glums, the voices from the past we hear in these entries reassure us that we're all part of a great cosmic parade, that restlessness and self-doubt have always been a constant of the human condition, and that tourists have been getting ripped off by New Yorkers ever since Henry Hudson stepped ashore in 1609. In his diary entry for September 5th of that year, Hudson notes that he was greeted by swarthy natives wearing the skins of foxes and other animals. Hudson concludes his first impressions of Gotham's original residents by saying, "They appear to be a friendly people, but have a great propensity to steal and are exceedingly adroit in carrying away whatever they take a fancy to." Of course, had those natives scribbled their own diary entries for posterity, they would have had their own tales to tell of getting conned by Hudson and his crew, who traded mere trinkets for maize and tobacco. Given the limitations of recorded history, however, Carpenter has unearthed an impressive range of New York diary entries. If not so diverse in race, the diarists included in this anthology are certainly diverse in class and politics. We hear from Tory foot soldiers engaged in the Battle of Long Island, piano manufacturer William Steinway dealing with workmen striking for an 8-hour day in May of 1872, and Congresswoman Bella Abzug strategizing for New York City statehood during that same month almost 100 years later. Carpenter's smart move was to arrange this collection not chronologically, but day by day throughout the calendar year. Indeed, I think the most fun way to read New York Diaries would be to keep it by your bedside and limit yourself to reading the entries for each day, because the effect oftentimes is of a chorus of voices separated by decades, even centuries, unconsciously echoing the same sentiments and complaints. For instance, January 18th seems to be rife with minor health problems. In 1790, on that day, George Washington is indisposed with an aching tooth and inflamed gum. His grousing is followed by that of Tennessee Williams in 1943, who bemoans another case of what he jokes is his occupational disease, crab lice. As you'd expect, so many entries here attest to the magic of the city. Mayor Philip Hone recalls an exotic exhibition of two giraffes in a lot on Broadway in July of 1838. And my favorite diarist, 10-year-old Catherine Elizabeth Havens, in entries written during 1850, describes the wonders of A.T. Stewart's department store, as well as her own mother's childhood recollections of ice skating on the canal that's now Canal Street. Long ago, Havens tells us, those New Yorkers too poor to afford ice skates would simply polish a rib of beef and fasten it on their shoes to skate on. Amidst these exuberant entries, though, other, grittier images of New York push through. DeWitt Clinton, in July of 1850, whines about city flies in his food. Diarist George Templeton Strong, a year later, describes gangs of child prostitutes on Broadway. And throughout the centuries of diary entries, the unavoidable voyeurism of New York City life intrudes. The painter John Sloan is transfixed in June of 1906 by a scene he spies in a room across from his own apartment, a baby dying in its mother's arms. Sloan writes that the mother held her child until it started to pale and stiffen. He eloquently concludes, hope tried to fight off fact, then fact killed hope in her. The one disappointment in this anthology is the lack of similar eloquence on the part of those bloggers whose posts Carpenter quotes for September 11th and its aftermath. One typical post reads, "The World Trade Center doesn't exist anymore. This is very weird." Maybe the bloggers Carpenter chose weren't equal to the task of immediately capturing the city's greatest tragedy in language. Maybe there's something about the spur-of-the-moment ease of blogging itself that weakens the intensity of those entries. One thing I do know is that I'm grateful that that momentous 1609 diary entry by Henry Hudson says more than, "Greeted by swarthy natives, this is very weird."
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed New York Diaries by Teresa Carpenter. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a 1978 recording by singer Barbara Lee, who died last week at the age of 82. Later this week, we'll listen back to her 1991 Fresh Air concert and interview.
Too late now to forget your smile, the way we cling when we've danced a while. Too late now to imagine myself each word makes my heart rejoice. Too late now to forget and go on to someone new. All the times we've had
People in the world, roughly 10% of the population, have something rather particular in common. They've been called artistically gifted and self-reliant, but also untrustworthy and insincere. A lot of mysteries and misconceptions surround this group, actually, which is of special interest to me since, well, I'm a part of it. We're talking about left-handed people. And the man we'll meet next knows a thing or two about the subject. Not only is Rick Smits a lefty himself, but his new book, The Puzzle of Left-Handedness, dives into the history, culture, and science of hand preference.
Throughout history, there was, Western history, I should say, there has always been sort of a negative whiff around left-handedness, but it wasn't taken very far, usually. For instance, if you look at the witch hunts of the Middle Ages, left-handedness was never used as a real sign of the devil, for one thing. Now, that's strange, because everything that they could lay their hands on was used to condemn people in those days. The stigma got worse once psychology was invented at the end of the 19th century, and that's when you find these very stern people who really think that we left-handers are really maladjusted and sick and what have you.
Was it Abram Blau who talked about infantile negativism and left-handed people?
Yeah, I think. Oh, he was. He can't have been a fun person.
What did he mean by that infantile negativism?
Well, he thought that children were willfully left-handed just to spite their parents, basically, which is complete bollocks. Try and find left-handers whom you suspect of being left-handed just to spite you. Well, you won't be able to find them. They're just normal, ordinary people.
I know there are places you mentioned in your book, like China, for instance, where they do not discriminate.
The Chinese, they simply don't have the same kind of negative connotations to the left that we have. We have a culture, let's say the Christian culture, Christian-based cultures, are very much oriented towards opposites, black and white, good and bad, left and right. It's all sort of dichotomies that we live by. And the Chinese don't do that and have this, let's say, this more harmonious idea of opposites that are complements to one another to form a harmonic whole, the yin and yang principle. And within that idea, the whole idea of good and bad as things that are, well, with their backs to one another and really each other's enemy, simply doesn't arise.
Well, you write about several possible explanations for why people are left-handed, but I get the impression we don't really have an answer as to why we prefer one hand over another.
No, and that's basically because science is still sort of guessing at what goes on inside our skulls. And what you see is that left-handedness has some sort of a hereditary component, but it's not neat. It doesn't conform to what you would normally expect. So you have to look for something special, something other. And this is what people have tried to do with, well, marginal success, because there's nothing really that explains the whole phenomenon.
Rick, are there advantages to being left-handed?
Yes, if you are a sportsman, like tennis or baseball or boxing, anything that has two adversaries in sort of personal combat. People think that that is because right-handers have very few chances of training with left-handers, whereas left-handers can always train with right-handers.
On the flip side, then, do we have clear evidence of when being a lefty is actually a real disadvantage?
In the army, in a big orchestra, that's where you're really at a disadvantage. You wouldn't want one violinist to bow away the other way from all the others. You get a bloodbath on the stage. And in the army, it's exactly the same thing. You need everybody to have his sword or his gun or whatever throughout history. You always want everybody to behave exactly the same. That's where the strength of an army is. And if somebody sort of breaks ranks, what you get is, well, real risk for everybody.
So that's a clear disadvantage, although I guess it does
help. If you want to go in for the military, yes.
But if you want to be president of the United States, for example?
Well, it's a nice coincidence that 5 out of the 7 last presidents are left-handed, but don't get up your hopes too far. It's a very small community, presidents. It's very slow in growing, so your chances are still about nil of getting there. And left-handedness, I don't think it will be a real advantage in that respect. Now, a quick mouth and a quick mind is probably better.
Rick Smits is the author of The Puzzle of Left-Handedness. He joined me from Amsterdam. Thanks so much, Rick.
Okay, glad to be there.
We leave you this hour with some dystopian visions of the future from novels. Writer Drew McGarry grew up watching The Jetsons, that happy futuristic family living in a sky-high apartment. Well, for our series 3 books, McGarry recommends 3 novels that present the future in a darker light.
When I was a kid, I assumed that in the future, things would get better and better and better till we were all driving flying cars and playing badminton with space aliens on top of 500-story buildings. I kind of count on this happening, frankly. But I don't assume we'll just keep going up anymore. I think there's probably a point to which civilization will evolve, and then all the gas and water will run out, and we'll spend the rest of eternity trying to get back to the awesome times when we had, like, food to eat. Anyway, here are 3 books that envision life on Earth after that dreaded turning point, starting with World War Z by Max Brooks. Yes, I'm aware that it's physiologically impossible for dead people to get up and start walking around and eating other people. And yet you never know now, do you? There isn't a person alive who has read this book that hasn't immediately started making mental plans for the coming zombie apocalypse. I belong to a generation that is constantly taunted by potential worldwide plagues like SARS and avian flu. None of those things have ended up killing us all, but honestly, it's only a matter of time before the other shoe drops. We've kind of earned it, frankly. God will only accept so many Real Housewives franchises before he decides to swing karma the other way. Richard Matheson's hero in I Am Legend experiences both the loss of his wife and of humanity. But just to make things a little more horrible, Matheson also puts him under constant siege from bloodthirsty vampires. And that's a fun thing to consider in an age of rapidly dwindling natural resources. Once we run out of the basics, we may find ourselves at each other's mercy, spending the rest of our lives hiding from one another and just trying to stay alive, never being allowed even the tiny luxury to sit down in peace and process our grief. When I was in 4th grade, my teacher asked me to do a book report. So, because I hated reading, I chose the novelization of RoboCop. This was not a real book. It was merely a product tie-in to one of the most violent films of the 1980s. But it had pages and a cover, which made it legit enough for me. I wound up getting a C. I am now a published novelist. And if that doesn't terrify you about our coming future, well, then you're a stronger person than I. So there you have it. 3 novels that clearly demonstrate our inevitable future downfall. When you're hoarding gas and roaming the countryside with a shotgun in 2031, don't say you weren't adequately warned.
That's Drew McGarry. His novel is a creepy futuristic thriller called The Postmortal.